Our first speaker we're glad to have is Dr. Walter Bradley, and he's going to talk about the mystery of life's origin, reassessing current theories again. And he has a BS in engineering science and physics and a PhD in material science and engineering, both from the University of Texas. He's been in academia for quite some time, an assistant associate professor of mineralogy engineering from the Colorado School of Mines, a professor of mechanical engineering, Texas A&M, and currently is a distinguished professor in mechanical engineering at Baylor. Areas of research specializing in polymer science and engineering, high-performance composite materials, time-dependent fracture, and anyway, you can tell I'm an electrical engineer, not a mechanical engineer, so this is all great to me. He has two awards from in teaching and in quite a number of other things. We're very grateful to have him speak today.
Thank you. It's good to be here today, and thank you for coming. I'm going to hustle so I can hopefully get to the end of the talk, which is the most interesting part, without running out of time. So let's go. You may wonder, what is a mechanical engineering professor doing talking about the origin of life? And the answer is, I have no degrees in mechanical engineering. I had the ironical privilege of being the department chair of the largest ME department in the country at Texas A&M with no degrees in mechanical engineering, although I didn't go around bragging about that, okay? But my background is basically in engineering science and polymer science and engineering. And so my background is quite related in the sense that the origin of life has to do with polymers and how you put them together and so forth. And that's essentially what I've been doing in polymer science and engineering for quite a few years. In 1984, I co-authored with two friends, or we had published, and we worked on it for 5 or 6 years, a book called The Mystery of Life's Origin, Reassessing Current Theories. And what I want to do today is to go back and say, it's 30 years later, and if I were going to write this book now, what would I change and what would still be the same? Okay, how has the field progressed in the 30 years since this book was published? Well, let's begin with, how was it received at the time? It had a very, very good jacket endorsement from Robert Jastrow, the director of the Goddard Space Center, and a professor at Columbia University. I might add, an agnostic, not a Christian. Ditto Robert Shapiro, who got his PhD from Harvard and taught biochemistry at New York University for many years until he died several years ago. Clifford Matthews, who got a gold medal for a career award in the Origin of Life contributions, actually called me after the book came out and wanted to get 10 copies for all of his graduate students. He didn't agree with what we had in the epilogue where we talked about possible implications, but he was very interested in having them read what we had to say about the science of this. We got a full two-page review in Chemical and Engineering News. Yale Journal of Biology and Medicine wrote, "The volume as a whole is devastating to a relaxed acceptance of current theories about biogenesis. It's well written and has been received by many who are working in the field." I subsequently went to a Gordon Research Conference. I'd been going each year for several years as we were writing the book, and I was curious to see if anybody would have read it when we were there. I had 7 different people come up and say, "We read your book," and 6 of them said, "We really liked it," and 1 said, "I didn't like it." And I asked why, and he said, "Well, it's too damn good for a creationist book." So, which I took as a compliment. Okay. Well, here were the significant claims that we made back in 1984, and then we'll be looking at what's changed since then, which of these might still have some validity, and which ones have been resolved. To begin with, no significant concentration of reducing gases, this would be things like methane, hydrogen, ammonia, in prebiotic atmosphere. Turns out that the molecules we're trying to build, the biopolymers, are basically ones that are more energetic. They have a higher state of energy. They're not as stable. Okay, I'm low here means more negative. Okay, I'm going to get down into the weeds if I'm not careful. But let's say these are energy-rich gases that in a atmosphere that allows lots of ultraviolet light from the sun are not that stable. And so accumulating a significant concentration of these is not that easy. NASA came along about 1980 and said, really, you couldn't have had much more than water, carbon dioxide, and nitrogen. And those aren't energy rich. And so when you put them together, They don't really chemically react because they're not energetically favorable. So no significant concentration of building blocks like amino acids or nucleotides would have accumulated in the prebiotic ocean and ponds, and there was never any good geological evidence to support that they were ever there. Chemical cross-reactions are a huge problem. If you make a prebiotic soup, you have all these different molecules, MERS, that can chemically react. The problem is it's not like doing it in a lab where you put in all amino acids and have them react and try to get them to polymerize. You've got lots of other things that are more reactive with amino acids than they are with each other. The so-called L and D, left-handed and right-handed kinds of molecules that are going to have to polymerize in a way that gives all L amino acids or only L amino acids, for example, in protein. And this is still a huge problem. Prebiotic simulation experiments often were run that bore very little resemblance to the early Earth's atmosphere and conditions. The need to eliminate investigator interference. If you're going to run a prebiotic simulation experiment, it ought to be something that could have happened in the early Earth, not something that can happen in somebody's chemistry lab. And then how to get sequencing in biopolymers that gives biological function. So these were basically the claims that we made at that time, and I think that none of those were particularly criticized in the four or five major book reviews that we had. A lot of the biggest part of the criticism had to do with what we considered implications of this, which was in an epilogue. I was excited to go in 1986 to the International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life conference at Cal Berkeley. They only have this every third year, and so it was my first opportunity after the book was published to go and get some more feedback and also learn where the field was headed at that point in time. I actually did two different presentations there. They were things I had done post-book that I was also interested in getting more feedback on. The two things that were highlights for me of the conference were the debate that they had between the protein-first people and the DNA-first people having to do with the origin of life. The protein-first people basically made very persuasive arguments that DNA couldn't have come first because you can't make it without protein. And the DNA people were quick to respond by arguing that the protein first doesn't work because protein by itself doesn't do the things that are necessary. And in my view, they both were persuasive that neither of these was a viable option for how life began, protein first or DNA first. Then later in the conference, a plenary lecture was given. This was a plenary debate in lieu of a lecture, so these were some of the main events at the conference, and certainly the ones I thought, if I'd been organizing the conference, would have been the right topics. It was a plenary lecture by Robert Shapiro, same fellow who did the jacket endorsement for our book, distinguished professor of biochemistry at New York University, on challenges of making RNA in prebiotic conditions. And he did something very interesting. I think at that point in time, 1986, everybody thought you could make RNA under prebiotic conditions, and it had already been done back in the 60s. What he did was to go through and trace all of the references from 1985, 84, all the way back, and it was people quoting other people quoting other people. It was almost like a nice gossip chain. And they all traced back to one paper that was published in 1968. And he quoted from that paper, the people who'd written it said, we were trying to find if we'd been able to synthesize any RNA under prebiotic conditions, and we never could find any, but we were still hopeful maybe it was in there someplace, and we didn't have good enough means of extracting it if it was in small yields. Then he went through and spent the whole rest of his lecture showing all the different reasons why it's essentially impossible to make RNA under prebiotic conditions. And at the end of his lecture, this is a plenary lecture, there's 300 people there, all of the main people who do origin of life research in the world. And at this point in time, people were moving toward RNA first, because the idea was RNA can do some of the catalytic functions that proteins do and can do some of the things that DNA does and certainly can duplicate or replicate itself. And so the hope was that an RNA was a simpler starting point because it did some of the things that protein and DNA did. Trying to get DNA and protein at the same time, accidentally, seemed like a pretty improbable event. So an RNA first looked like it had better possibilities. As he went through and critiqued RNA and how the problems with making it under prebiotic conditions, He made a very, very strong case for the fact that this is something that doesn't really look like it's going to be feasible to do. At the end of his lecture, they opened it up for questions. 300 people that were there, no questions, not one. The audience was just stunned by both what he'd shown with his literature review. It said there wasn't any literature that said RNA had been made under prebiotic conditions, and his arguments as to why that didn't seem feasible. Jim Ferris, who was the editor of Origin of Life and Evolution of the Biosphere, was the person who was moderating the session, and he basically, at the end, waited for questions. There was this very long, pregnant pause, no questions, and then he said, Bob, he said, I don't disagree with anything you said in your talk, but do you have to be so pessimistic? And it was probably the most dramatic talk I ever heard in 42 years of going to conferences of any type, including material science. Well, let's ask the question, does Origin of Life look like this or like that? The figure on the left comes out of Richard Dawkins' book, Climbing Mount Improbable, in which he shows a rock in Hawaii that casts a shadow. Let's be sure you see what's what. Okay, here's the shadow. Here's the rock. And at a certain time of the year, at a certain direction, or a certain time of day, this rock casts a shadow that looks famously like an American president. And probably for those of you who are younger, you won't recognize this. But for those of you that are my age, you would probably recognize it. It's a good silhouette of John F. Kennedy. But you can go look at the rock and quickly conclude there's no evidence of anybody having altered this rock. It just looks like it weathered. And it happened to weather in a way that looks like gives a shadow or a silhouette of John F. Kennedy. Now, if you go to Mount Rushmore, you see this, 20 years worth of work by a whole team of people led by one particular guy. And nobody would say, look at what the wind, the rain, and the sleet, and the hail created here, okay? I think people would say, this is clearly the work of some intelligent agency, okay? The guys that actually did the carving. And so the question is, does the origin of life look like this, as Richard Dawkins would say? It might look like it was the result of some design, but on the other hand, in reality, it is not on closer inspection, and if we keep looking, we'll find the way. Or does it look more like this, where we would say, well, clearly that looks like something that required some special provision? Let me emphasize, which I always do when I give talks on this topic, one cannot scientifically prove or disprove God's existence. Okay? And I think several of the talks today have made that very, very clear claim. Important disclaimer, it's impossible to prove or disprove the existence of God with the tools of science, dealing as it does with secondary causes. God would be a primary cause. However, the nature of nature can give us very important hints about whether it just happened by accident, or is it the product of purposeful design. Okay, so what we're going to do in this presentation is we're going to explain what needs to be accounted for in the origin of life. We're going to talk about what can be explained scientifically with our current level of understanding. Is it reasonable to posit a completely natural explanation? Okay. For me, that's describing God working in his patterned or customary way for the origin of life. Or did God do anything extraordinary or miraculous? I think God did it one way or the other. The only question is how. Well, let's say, what distinguishes living systems from non-living systems? All living systems process energy, they store information, and they replicate. And that means we need these sort of molecular machinery to accomplish these essential life functions, and these are obviously going to be enzymatic proteins, DNA, and then RNA, either messenger, well, not R, both messenger and tRNA, as well as proteins. Okay, I want to show a real short video clip, I think, that will help you to see how these all work in nature, and then we'll talk a little bit about how hard is it to make
the
them.
The concept of the intelligent design of life is immensely attractive to me and made a great deal of sense, as it very closely matched the multiple discoveries in molecular biology.
In the years since Kenyon's rejection of chemical evolution, science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins.
Okay, this is the tRNA molecule. These are the amino acids.
A molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long.
Okay, these are the amino acids.
The sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
Okay, now this is how living systems operate today. Obviously, the assumption would be at the origin of life, some simpler precursor to all of this would have been doing at least the necessary and essential tasks, but not necessarily with the elegance that we see here. It takes about 250 proteins to work all the different things that are required in a simple living cell, and obviously you would have to imagine a origin of life starting with a much simpler scheme. Okay, so the molecular machinery that we just saw here, the DNA, stores information for sequencing amino acids to make proteins, and proteins do all of the other functions within the cell. Messenger RNA essentially is a copy made from DNA that takes that information outside the nucleus of the cell. Transcription RNA uses the information from messenger RNA to sequence 20 different types of amino acids to give the protein chain that sequence that will allow it to fold into the three-dimensional structure, which is critical then to its enzymatic function. And this is what essentially the picture was showing. Let's focus for just a minute on this particular part of that whole operation, transcription RNA molecules. Back in 1956, Crick and Watson were sort of puzzling over how you could take this information from base pairs and use that to somehow sequence amino acids. If you just look at the molecules or sizes or geometries or chemical affinities, it seemed hard to imagine how you could get the information from DNA into a sequenced amino acid polypeptide that would then have this function. Okay, so here's examples of four different amino acids. We're going to try to be sequencing things like this using triplicates, codons here, bases. It's really hard to imagine how that might get done. OK, Okay, so what Crick proposed, which Watson at the time disagreed with, was that we must have an adapter molecule, in a sense something like a language translator, that on one end will uniquely hook to, for example, these three bases, okay? And on the other end will uniquely, uniquely attach itself to valine, okay? And if this is all done properly, then I'm going to be able to translate with these molecules. Notice I need 20 of these, if I have 20 amino acids, because I need uniquely one of these adapter molecules. This is the transcription RNA for each different amino acid. Okay, here's actually what this might look like in practice, transcription RNA. And on one end, it's going to attach itself to the codons. On the other end, it's going to attach itself to the amino acid. And that's what we saw in the video, is how we transcribe this information from the DNA into a sequence of amino acids, which is how things happen in the living cell. Keith Miller and Joseph Levine's biology book, probably the most popular college-level biology book that's used for freshmen, says the largest stumbling block in building the gap between living and not living and living still remains. All living cells are controlled by information stored in DNA, which is transcribed in RNA and then made into protein. This is a very complicated system, and each of these three molecules requires the other two, either to put it together or to help it work. DNA, for example, carries information but cannot put that information to use or even copy itself without the help of RNA and protein. You can see why at the conference I was talking about in 1984, there was a lot of discussion about how do we get started, because you need all three of these ideally, and it's hard to figure out how to get even one of them. Okay, I think what's happened, probably the biggest change since 1984 has been, in 1984, this was the idea of what we had to get done. I think today, the assumption is we start with RNA. RNA then, once started, can somehow help us to move to a next step where we have some RNA with enzyme assistance, okay, encoding proteins. And then we can evolve again over further time into what we have today, DNA producing RNA, producing protein, but again with the help of these enzymes, which are protein molecules themselves. So it was hard to imagine how this system could ever have been the beginning point for life. This is what we think may be the beginning point for life today, but it has some problems of its own. In Scientific American, October 2011, they had 10 great mysteries of chemistry, unsolved mysteries. And one of those, the first one, in fact, was the origin of life. And they say in their article, the moment when the first living beings arose, inanimate matter almost 4 billion years ago, is still shrouded in mystery. How did relatively simple molecules in the primordial broth give rise to more and more complex compounds? And how did some of those compounds begin to process energy, replicate two of the defining characteristics of life? The RNA World Hypothesis, Journal of Astrobiology, had a kind of a review of the RNA hypothesis 50 years later, because it was actually first proposed in the 1960s, although it didn't have a lot of support at that time. In April, and their article begins early with indicating RNA molecules are alleged to be the key to a chemical pathway for the origin of life. Figuring out how to make RNA under prebiotic conditions is still the prebiotic chemist's worst nightmare. The hypothetical path requires these different steps, making the amino acids, bases, and sugars, assembling those into the polymers by chemical reactions, excluding other mers such as wrong kinds of sugars from joining into the polymer as it forms. Joining of mers into polymers must be made with the right chemical bonds. We need to have a sequence of mers that gives some catalytic activity. And if everything happens correctly, RNA should be able to replicate itself and provide some catalytic activity. Jack Szostaki wrote a really good article in Scientific American in 2009 trying to describe the problems and what kinds of things that he's doing to try to address these. As a Nobel Prize winning chemist, he can now do whatever he wants, and one of the things he's working on is the origin of life. He says it's virtually impossible to imagine how a cell's machines, which are mostly protein-based catalysts called enzymes, could have formed spontaneously as it first arose. George Whiteside, the world's most cited living chemist in 2011, commented most recently, I don't understand how you go from a system that's random chemicals to something that becomes, in a sense, a Darwinian set of chemical reactions that are getting more complicated spontaneously. I just don't understand how that works. I would highly recommend a TED Talk that he did. If you just go put his name in at YouTube and hit return, you'll find a TED Talk he gave in 2014. And he had a great illustration in there. He took a big bag of Legos and he said, now, here's a train over here, and it was a really complicated train, and here's the bag of Legos from which that train can be made. And he said, this is where we're at in the origin of life. We understand how to make the Lego pieces. What we can't figure out is how to convert those into the train. Robert Shapiro, writing much later, I think 2007, on the origin of life, said a profound difficulty exists, same Robert Shapiro, however, with the idea of RNA or any other replicator at the starting of life. Existing replicators can serve as templates for the synthesis of additional copies of themselves, but this device cannot be used for the preparation of the very first molecules, which must arise spontaneously from an unorganized mixture. The formation of an information-bearing homopolymer through undirected chemical synthesis appears to be very improbable. Okay, well, let me do this. I'm going to simply, you can read this as quickly as possible. Okay. Okay, let me finish with one short video. This is a metaphor for what I'll explain in a second. Okay, let me simply conclude. What does that have to do with this talk? We don't know what we'll find in the future, and we may find eventually that there is some amazing and highly improbable chemical pathway to get from simple building blocks, Legos, to that complicated train. But if we do, I think some people, some atheistic scientists will say, well, see, that proves God doesn't exist. No. The fact that if a pathway does exist, if that's exactly how God did it, and we may someday find that, that'll simply prove that this was not something that happened by chance. We can explain everything in that video with physics, can we not? But you can't explain that whole process. There's too many things to it that had to be, in a sense, contrived. And I think that at the end of the day, that's what we will potentially find as we find how life actually began. Let me stop there. I know I'm more or less out of time, but maybe we have time for couple of questions.
quick question, but that's sneaking in the last one.
I'll let you pick one question, Walter.
Yes.
Walter, I was at an ACS conference this last spring. I went to the old symposium on organic chemistry and space.
Mm-hmm.
And I found mainly Origin of Life guys there.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen the tendency in recent years to try to move the scenario to outer space to find a lot of organic molecules and groups that already have?
You know, that is a popular idea because of the trouble we're having on Earth making these things. But it's not new. Way back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that was kind of started by NASA people who were saying it's so hard to make building blocks here, much less to make molecules, that maybe they came from outer space and maybe they came with a large enough number that's how we accumulated the concentrations we needed to make the chemistry work. Yeah, one other quick question.
Do you get a sense that those working in astrobiology have an appreciation for what you, because that is what you've been talking about in your talks, because that's where I see a huge disconnect in the field. You know, people who are doing astronomers often are looking for conditions, right, for life, where they think life will just automatically, spontaneously happen, and they have very, very little appreciation. But what's your experience in that?
Well, I think if you just look at the literature, I think that it's very clear that you look at TED Talks on this topic, and they basically say essentially what I'm saying, okay, and we're talking about some of the very best chemists in the world today, not just somebody individually doing that. So I think it's widely recognized this as a problem. There was an article this spring in March or April that was talking about a different way, a guy named Sutherland, who's been trying to solve these problems, to get around these problems, and they start out with what they call a prebiotic simulation experiment, except they're starting with acetylene, cyanide, okay? Hydrogen cyanide. These are not, particularly acetylene is not the kind of a chemical you're going to have in a prebiotic earth. And then they're doing it in a chemistry lab where there's no other cross reactions. All of the things we mentioned at the beginning that we said in our book were problems are all still there. They're the same problems. We're just working with RNA instead of with trying to synthesize DNA or protein. But no, I think what I'm sharing with you is really current state of the art. Okay, thank you.